At a time when Cyril Ramaphosa was at the Oval Office and saying to Donald Trump, we want to host you in South Africa in November, of course, I'm handing over the G20 presidency to you. That's significant because South Africa hands over to the United States. I remember thinking, Donald Trump's going to say he'll attend and then he won't attend just to F around with South Africa, because that's what these power dynamics, these infantile, I may call them, power dynamics are about. You just want to just kick people around for no reason at all. The meanness is the aim.
This episode was brought to you by 91.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Readiness Report with me, Ridi Tlhabi, in partnership with the Daily Maverick. So I am talking to you a day or two after the President of the United States, where I live and work, posted on social media, because this is where we are now. Urgent and complex matters are communicated on social media platforms. He announced that he was withdrawing from participating in the G20, which of course is being hosted by South Africa. In fact, he specifically mentions that no US officials will be attending the G20, which starts in South Africa in a couple of days. I actually think it would help if I just read that tweet. It says, "It is a total disgrace that the G20 will be held in South Africa. Afrikaners, people who are descendant from Dutch settlers," he's calling them settlers, "from Dutch settlers and also French and German immigrants are being killed and slaughtered, and their land and farms are being illegally confiscated. No US government official will attend as long as these human rights abuses continue. I look forward to hosting the 2026 G20 in Miami, Florida." Okay, this is bullshit, right? You and I know that this is absolute BS, and I don't want to deal with it for now. But what I found interesting is that at a time when Cyril Ramaphosa was at the Oval Office and saying to Donald Trump, we want to host you in South Africa in November, of course, I'm handing over the G20 presidency to you. That's significant because South Africa hands over to the United States. I remember thinking, Donald Trump's going to say he'll attend and then he won't attend just to F around with South Africa, because that's what these power dynamics, these infantile, I may call them, power dynamics are about. You just want to just kick people around for no reason at all. The meanness is the aim. I, at that time, it was in May, I thought he's not going to come. But then a couple of months ago, he announced that J.D. Vance will attend. And I thought, okay, fine. There's some room for rational engagement. There are some adults in the room. And I thought that these meetings that have been going on between South Africa and the US, because they have been going on, they've yielded some fruit. There's been Alistair Reuters, who is the investment advisor to the president. He's being rumored. There are rumors that he'll be our next ambassador, South Africa's next ambassador to Washington. I don't know. But I know that there was this high-level delegation alongside the World Bank IMF annual meetings in October. And people who are privy to that information from both sides, from the US side and South Africa's side, are talking about constructive engagement. And I can guarantee you that they are flabbergasted by this latest move. Anyway, when J.D. Vance was announced, I thought, okay, fine, fruitful engagement. And now he's not coming. He's not coming. And he knew that he wouldn't be coming. I just first thought about this from a logistics point of view. You know, the visit of a VP of the United States is a big deal. It's a state-level mission that would have involved, you know, the Secret Service, transport authorities, logistics, communications, the media, the embassy in South Africa. There would already at this point be a country team as per protocol. The plans unfold over a 6 and 8 week period. They weren't just going to be making plans now in November. I can bet my last dollar on this, that there is already a team from the US side, a team from the vice president's office that is enjoying the Johannesburg spring, that is already there doing the reconnaissance, the threat assessments. They've done all of that. And secondly, with the United States, it also involves shipment of cargo planes, helicopter, medical equipment, satellite, communication equipment. That stuff must already be there in South Africa. And I've been told by a source at Durco that the US side, the embassy, they called and they were sheepish, they were embarrassed. Career diplomats, trade negotiators, officials from Treasury in the United States are embarrassed by this. I don't think that they support this, but it is, again, where we are with the president of the United States behaving in this manner. And I'm reading some analysis from some South African commentators that South Africa must reset the relations. South Africa must do this. It's nonsensical. It ignores the fact that you are dealing with a particular type of character who is the resident of the White House, that all these things that you are suggesting, that South Africa should have, should reach out to the United States, it should offer this, it should demonstrate this. Donald Trump knows all of that already. That's already been done, but you are dealing with a particular character in the United States. And I think that South Africa should just march forward, should just focus on the G20, should focus on the fact that they are the only country invited to the G7 convening of foreign ministers, make use of that. The COP conference, the climate conference has just concluded in Brazil. The United States was not there. In fact, the governor of California, Newsom, was there representing, in a way, the United States. So the United States is withdrawing from these multilateral organizations, and it is quite disappointing, and it is quite a sad development. What I do want to say is that you are not wrong if you are thinking that when Washington steps back, Beijing steps forward. When Washington withdraws, Beijing advances. When America disengages, others fill the space. China, India, the Gulf states. The US may call this whatever it wants to call it, kicking South Africa around. But geopolitically, it is a strategic blunder. It is also a blunder because there's a captive audience of African decision makers. This G20 is not just about South Africa. It is about Africa, the first one to be convened on African soil. But not only that, at the India summit in 2022, the AU was included as a member of the G20. So what the United States is doing is just subverting all these structures and disengaging from a continent and not just from South Africa. Anyway, guess who I have on the podcast today? When I started my career at Kaya FM in the early days, when I was behind the microphone presenting the afternoon drive on Kaya FM, there is one gentleman that we always went to for anything related to international relations, the United States and the world. He was incredible. And then I moved to the SABC. And again, his voice was just so educational. It was inspiring. It challenged us in so many ways. And I think Professor John Strömlö has contributed immensely to our understanding of foreign policy and US-Africa relations. I'm so delighted to reconnect with you, Professor John Strömlö, after all these years. I understand you are in cold Oxford.
Yes.
Why?
With a daughter who is now appointed a professor at Oxford. So that's to the good. But what her husband, who loves Vits, will do, and he's got a chair, but anyway, it's a very interesting time, Reedy, and I'm glad you're in Washington and not me. But anyway.
Okay, so what's your reaction to this? What do you make of this?
I go back a little bit further than you do on the realities of Trump and reading his niece's biography, and she's a trained psychologist, and she entitled the book, "Too Much Is Never Enough." And he is a bully, as you well know, pointed out at some length. But I did take his addressing egregious actions of the Republic of South Africa, which was Executive Order Number 3, issued on February 7, 2025, just after he became, it was Executive Order 3. It was, and it was woefully uninformed, but it had two basic principles in it. One, cut off all assistance to South Africa, and two, welcome Afrikaners as refugees. And so at least I thought that South Africa had forced him to declare himself the racist and the bully that he is, and also that he doesn't do his homework, but he careens around. Now, I should ask you what you make of the Democratic sweep last Tuesday, and that maybe there is hope at the end of the tunnel. But I think that South Africa should not lose its cool. I praised Cyril Ramaphosa for going the extra mile of engaging Trump. But I never, for the life of me, was under any illusions about his reliability. He's a bully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. He's unreliable as well. And I go back to a point that I made, that the meanness seems to be the point. A lot of the things that he does are absolutely not necessary. And you're asking my reaction to last week's what is called a blue wave. I too was quite optimistic when I saw what I saw. And I told a lot of my followers that you have to look at it beyond just New York City. That's the one we want to talk about because it's so historic. A child of immigrants, Mamdani, becomes the first Muslim mayor of New York. There was a huge Jewish vote there as well. A very eclectic mix of people living in New York. I just thought that it was incredible for the Dems that the nationwide sweep, whether you're looking at positions of governor, lieutenant governor, mayor, Supreme Court, attorney general races across the land, that they just show that the United States can fight to reclaim some of its founding values. I saw yesterday Donald Trump was publicly booed and it was so dramatic. It's the story that's being recorded, that's been reported here. And then J.D. Vance's brother didn't make it for mayor of Cincinnati, despite that high profile endorsement from him. Spanberger becomes the first woman governor. Virginia, you name it, there are multiple counties that turned blue. So, Prof, that kind of gives me hope that maybe the midterms will deliver something else. But I'm trying to be cautiously optimistic because I'm one of those people who thought there's no way Kamala Harris could lose to Donald Trump. Not because she was a perfect candidate, but because in the first presidency, Donald Trump had already demonstrated what he stands for. And he already articulated what he would do if he were to be elected again. It was a presidency that was run on racism, disrespect for women, misogyny, an Afrophobic tone, ignorance. So I didn't think that America would decide that's the man to return to the White House, but they did. So yeah, I'm optimistic. The No Kings rally that happened about a month ago, that has been positive. But I don't know, Prof. I don't know.
Change is daunting. Challenging, disorientating, unstoppable. Change is inevitable. Change is wise. Change is action. It's liberating, rewarding. Change is brave. Change is opportunity. We're always ready to invest in it. 91, investing for a world of change.
I don't know either because I was an observer. My wife and I were observers for the Carter Center in the 2024 election, and he did win, but he won very narrowly in the popular vote. In fact, it was the closest election in history but for the popular vote, but he did win substantially in the Electoral College, and he bills it as a major mandate, but it's not. And the MAGA crowd has him as a champion for bringing back the settler culture and white domination. It's make apartheid real again. And it's he's caught up in the 19th century. But his father and he also were sued by the federal government for discriminatory housing in Queens. And that was 20 years ago and or longer than that. And that he's always been the man that he's betraying himself as. And he did in the executive order, at least South Africa forced his hand because he likes to push around a vulnerable country that was historically aligned with the United States when it was under apartheid. And so ostensibly for the Cold War, but South Africans and the ANC have gone beyond that. And I'm just eager for sensible leadership in the U.S. to come back and to say that they need an ally and a supporter in the third world. And South Africa is the primary candidate. Now, South Africa will take a very careful position on whether it lies with itself, with the U.S., and rightly so, because it has a long experience in the struggle. But the U.S. is becoming a minority-majority country, and I don't think that the settlers can stop it. However, it is important to point out that in New York City, Mamdani won and swept the boroughs, but he lost in the white community because we vote our skin color. Still, but not everybody, obviously.
Yeah. Phew, that's very interesting. Do you think that people who analyze the outcome of the Mamdani victory from a national point of view, some people say New York is not the entire U.S. Just because it happened in New York, you can't expect it to be a microcosm of what could happen in the entire country. My reading of it is that Mamdani's victory was also a message to the Democrats, just in terms of how they communicate, the proximity that they're supposed to create, the issues that matter to people. And I know that with Mamdani, even now, there's still the shadow of Israel looming large on the outcome of this election, that it was about his stance on Israel. And even going forward, his success is being analyzed according to what he can or cannot do for Israel. He wasn't running for the mayor of Tel Aviv. He was running for mayor of New York City, even though there's a large Jewish constituency there. But the attempt to dilute his message, because his message was not really about geopolitics. It was about housing. It was about affordability and those kind of things. Are there lessons for the Democrats, do you think?
I think there are very profound lessons for the Democrats. Mahmoud Mamdani, his father, and was a professor at University of Cape Town, is an old friend from graduate school. And he born Zoran in Cape Town, he and his wife, and he dedicated Neither Settler Nor Native to Zoran. You teach us how to engage the world in difficult times. May you inspire many and blaze a trail. That is a father's testimony to a son who is really extraordinary. And you're right. He now has to deliver on a very hard set of issues that are nevertheless valued by the common person. And I think that, echoing the imperfect Franklin Roosevelt, you're going back to the New Deal. And it's going to be a fair deal this time, I hope. And he makes no bones about it, but it's got to be tested in a very difficult environment, namely New York City. But he's on to something that is very profound, and he's holding his head high, and he's being totally frank about where his loyalties lie, and they are to the common man and woman.
I'm very, just to pivot a little bit to something else, South Africa, the question of who's whispering to Trump. It's not the first time that AfriForum and Solidarity has lobbied U.S. lawmakers to take a particular stance on South Africa's domestic policy, BEE policies, BEE land, etc. They were not as successful in the first Trump term as they are right now. And there is a sense that the reframing of power and the migratory nature of your kind of right-wing rhetoric, it seems as if the people who didn't buy into the Rainbow Nation, the people who didn't vote yes to our dismantling of apartheid, have found a home in Trump, in America, in this new term of Donald Trump. We know about people are pejoratively or jokingly calling the Americanas, the refugees, the fact that there are so many people in different corners of the world who qualify for asylum, who qualify for refugee status, but
that's
he has
right.
exclusively giving it to white Afrikaners, many of whom are just milking it and using the tool of disinformation to spread their message. Why is this message landing in America today in the broader context?
Because he does not have any adults in the room as he had in his first term. And yet he did tweet as sympathetic words about AfriForum in the first term. And Cyril Ramaphosa, who was then a new president, said, bug out and don't mess around with the South Africa. And it was the only country that he commented on. Mm-hmm. And he's added in for South Africa because South Africa is founded on liberal principles that he disagrees with. And he's a 19th century kind of leader and would be an imperial or a fascist leader if the circumstances would allow it. And he's testing the Constitution every day. I'm not sure that we're out of the woods yet, but I'm encouraged by the results of last Tuesday. And I think that we may have turned the corner because he's also trying to distract us from the shutdown and the Epstein files.
And that's exactly what I think the right-wing elements in South Africa are missing. It seems to me that this is a victory for them that's built on quicksand. I'm fascinated yes. by the short-termism of America's electoral victories. We had an election last year. It's a year down the line. Just as you're catching your breath, there are the outcomes of the elections in New York and Virginia, as we've been speaking about. And then next year, you have the midterms. It's almost as if you've won, you can barely catch your breath until you are out again. So it feels to me that the right-wing elements in South Africa are really nailing their colors to the mast, and they are queers, their well-being to an America that is being run by Trump. But there are domestic realities here that are diluting Trump's power, and very quickly, their access may very well change.
Well, and they may change here in South Africa if your paper was right about publishing the interview with Blessy and Becky, who said that unless you pursue development, it's the common man will and women will abandon you and forever. And I don't know who they'll gravitate toward, but it is a paradox of democracy that you're dependent on the common man and woman to vote for your candidates. And that's, I think, the rule of law and elections are absolutely, and a free press. And there certainly is a free press in South Africa. My God, yes. Even the government station is critical of government. I think it's encouraging, but I just wish that America was not acting at cross purposes with South Africa. But at this late stage in the game, they could afford to support development and elimination of poverty and unemployment. And they should put the shoulder to the wheel. And I know that a lot of good Democrats, and I'm a member of Democrats Abroad in South Africa, and I'm also a member of the ANC, and I don't have any problems with the ideals of these organizations, but their daily work is tough.
No, that's absolutely true. So as we conclude, Prof, I posted certain positions and opinions because, again, being in Washington, I've been privy to the meetings, the going-ons, the briefings with some colleagues and friends in the State Department, knowing who's arriving from South Africa, who's speaking to whom. And one gets a sense that behind the scenes, where there are no optics, there are normal people talking and negotiating with each other. The showman is the president of the country. And I felt we'd reached a point where South Africa had explained itself on where it stands, on the white genocide, on expropriation of land. All of that had been explained, and there's nothing more to do. But I do know that in diplomacy, there's always more to do. However, how does South Africa continue to play the diplomatic role while also not being distracted? We are in command of the global stage at the G20, and South Africa must make it work without being distracted by the United States. But the reality is that Cyril Ramaphosa does have to hand over the presidency to the United States, and it is a given in G20 framework that the incumbent hands over, and the one who takes over will build on the themes that were started by the predecessor. There's no chance of that. Is the report and the themes, the decisions, are they just going to be tossed out the window because the president of the United States has decided, bugger South Africa?
That's the game that Trump is playing. And if I could hazard a couple of wishful thinkings, I would like to see the G20 downgrade itself to working level groups, which, of course, the Americans are not having working groups. There's a lot to build on that South Africa did over the course of its presidency, just as the Brazilians did in theirs, the Troika. And so I would hope that the G20, absent J.D. Vance, absent any U.S. high-level representation, could consider downgrading their participation, or even better, picking another country to be the president in 2026. There is no reason why the G20 is a flexible organization. They couldn't do this, but they probably won't. And I'm realistic enough to know that people like to hedge their bets. But I would like this to be the obvious point for South Africa to step up and show its leadership.
Okay. Always a joy speaking to you, and I'm so happy that we reconnected. Thank you, Prof.
Thank you, Reedy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Professor John Strimlock.